So let's talk about who benefits from a president-elect trashing the intelligence community. Who benefits from that, Director Clapper? The American people, them losing confidence in the intelligence community and the work of the intelligence community. Who actually is the benefactor of someone who is about to become commander-in-chief trashing the intelligence community?
I think there is an important distinction here between healthy skepticism, which policymakers, to include policymaker number one, should always have for intelligence. But I think there's a difference between skepticism and disparagement.
That was Missouri Senator, Democratic Senator Claire McCaskill questioning National Intelligence Director James Clapper at today's Senate Armed Services Committee hearing. Clapper's testimony backed up intelligence reports blaming Russia for email hacks of Democrats during the election. President-elect Donald Trump has scoffed at those reports and criticized agencies like the CIA and FBI for blaming the Russians. He also is denying a Wall Street Journal report today that he plans to make cuts to Clapper's office and to the CIA, while separate reports name former Indiana Senator Dan Coats as Trump's pick to succeed Clapper. For more on all of this and for a bigger look at our intelligence apparatus, I'm joined now by Scott Shane. He is national security reporter for The New York Times. Welcome.
Hi, thanks for having me on.
Well, today, James Clapper did not reveal any new big piece of information about the hacks or intelligence pointing to Russia. But what was your main takeaway from the hearing today?
Well, I think really what we saw was top intelligence officials and certainly the vast majority of the senators on the committee of both parties making very clear that they believe the Russian government was indeed behind the hack and leak to influence the presidential election. And that is, of course, what President-elect Trump has repeatedly cast doubt on, denied, essentially on a couple of occasions questioned the competence and sort of political impartiality of the intelligence agencies. So, you know, it was pretty much a united front setting up what will be kind of an extraordinary meeting tomorrow between the leaders of the intelligence community, including Jim Clapper, the DNI, and Vice President-elect Trump, in which they'll give him a very detailed account of their evidence, you know, much more detailed account than the rest of us will get, the highly classified stuff, the same briefing that President Obama got today.
Yeah.
And they'll lay it all out, and President-elect Trump will have to decide whether to change course and accept the findings of the agencies that he will soon command, or, really, in effect, throw the agencies into an unprecedented crisis.
Now, he has said he has his own information on the hacking that he is going to reveal at some point. Do we know what that information could possibly be?
I certainly have no idea and not even a notion of where he might have gotten such information. I mean, there are a lot of private cybersecurity experts, and undoubtedly, you know, some of them have been in touch with the transition office. So maybe he's got somebody who's cast out on this for technical reasons. There are at least some experts who do not, they don't deny that Russia is behind the hack or Russian government's behind the hack, but they do say that based on the evidence made public so far, they don't think the case has been proven. I should say that the majority of sort of private cybersecurity experts do believe the case is overwhelming and very strong, but perhaps he's heard from one of the skeptics, and that will presumably give him some questions to present to Mr. Clapper and the heads of the CIA and FBI and others.
Now, he has said, allegedly, not he, but some of his associates quoted in the Wall Street Journal today, that he wants to maybe make some cuts to Clapper's office or perhaps get rid of it, restructure the CIA, streamline the intelligence apparatus. Now it's being reported that he wants former Senator Dan Coats of Indiana to be the new National Intelligence Director. What do you make of all of this?
Well, I mean, I think, it's my impression that this is all still in flux. The idea that the Director of National Intelligence Office is an unnecessary layer of bureaucracy is not a new one. It goes back all the way to 2004 when that idea was first proposed. A lot of intelligence officials thought it was a bad idea for precisely that reason. They thought it would just, you know, sort of expand the bureaucracy and make it less likely that critical information would reach the people who needed it. The idea in the wake of 9/11 was that the Director of National Intelligence would sort of make sure the agencies, and there are 16 intelligence agencies, a lot of people would be surprised to know, under the DNI, that they would be coordinated, they'd be sharing information, and they would, you know, catch, for example, a big terrorist plot like 9/11 plot well in advance. So that's not a new question, but if he's going to appoint Dan Coats to be the new Director of National Intelligence, presumably there will be time to kind of go over this. It would require legislation, actually. Congress would have to act to abolish the office of DNI. So I suspect that for months and months we'll be hearing about the various possibilities for intelligence reform and restructuring.
Well, is there a case to be made? You said 16 intelligence agencies the DNI oversees. Is there a case to be made that that's maybe too many intelligence agencies, that it is bloated?
Absolutely. I mean, I think there are a lot of intelligence experts who think that some of these agencies are too big, some of them are redundant, that sort of every little part of the military or part of the government wants its own little intelligence unit, and sometimes not so little, and that they are sort of just grabbing turf and not coordinating their activities very well, and that was one of the factors behind the failure to prevent the 9/11 attacks. So, I mean, it's not, again, this is not something that Mr. Trump is introducing for the new, you know, from out of the blue. It's much discussed in Washington, but I just think that it will take quite a while to sort of hash out after he takes the presidency.
But what about this idea that perhaps it might be bloated, but also this idea that the intelligence itself might not be trustworthy? He has said, Donald Trump has said, and many people agree with him, that the intelligence was faulty, the intelligence that led to the Iraq war, and that he says these are the same people that said Saddam Hussein had weapons of mass destruction. Was it, in fact, bad intelligence that led to that, or was it misinterpretation of intelligence?
I mean, some of it was bad intelligence. There was a national intelligence estimate that was about Saddam Hussein's weapons of mass destruction that was clearly wrong. And Jim Clapper, the DNI, was asked about that at today's hearing. And he said, you know, he basically acknowledged that intelligence was wrong and said that they had learned lessons and improved since then. He said, among other things, that a healthy skepticism, bringing a healthy skepticism to the judgment of the intelligence agencies is totally okay, and that he encouraged that. What he didn't like from the president-elect was disparagement of the intelligence agencies.
Scott Shane, national security reporter for The New York Times. Thanks for joining us.
You're very welcome.
On to a local FBI investigation now, one that involves child pornography and Best Buy. In 2011, a physician in Orange County brought his computer to Best Buy's Geek Squad for a fix. One of those geeks found a photo of a young naked girl in the computer's trash, and he was reportedly, this geek, an FBI informant. The FBI then seized the hard drive. The customer was arrested. A lawyer for the doctor says the Geek Squad is acting as a creep squad for the FBI and that the technicians were acting as secret law enforcement agents and shouldn't be able to search computers without a warrant. The OC Weekly reported this story, and editor Gustavo Arellano joins me now. Welcome.
Hola, Madeline.
Well, briefly walk us through the facts of this case. What happened?
So you have the prominent Orange County physician and surgeon, Mark Rettenmeyer. He goes into Best Buy. His laptop's not booting up. So he says, hey, Geek Squad, can you fix this for me? The Geek Squad then, according to documents, they find this image of a naked girl. What they tell the authorities is that they just found it with a routine search. Using that image, then they went to a judge, and they were able to get a warrant to go search into the surgeon Rettenmeier's house, and then on that basis, they were able to arrest him. But the defense attorney said that this image, the surgeon did not know this image was on the computer, and more importantly, that this image was only accessible by very specific forensic devices that would require more than just a Geek Squad. The Geek Squad might be very smart and geek, but they do not have these tools. The FBI does. And the most fascinating thing about this case is that not only was there one informant for the FBI in this particular Geek Squad in Mission Viejo, there was three of them.
And that's undisputed, that they were informants for the FBI?
This is what court records are saying. This is what the attorney, in fact, we got a comment from Best Buy, the mothership of Best Buy, and they said, we did not authorize this if, in fact, they were informants for the FBI. It was an individual decision and not something that we go, although the attorney is also alleging that that's not the case at all.
They also said in that statement that they're required by law to report the discovery of certain illegal materials to law enforcement. I didn't know that they were required by law to do that.
Well, I think that, and that's not even what's being disputed by the attorney, James Ritter, because like it goes back to the old days. Like if you're processing film, back when you used to process camera film, and you saw images that depicted violence or child pornography, you would report them to the police, law enforcement and whatnot. The specifics of this case is that the only way to access this particular image, like I'm not much of a geek, well, I'm a different type of geek. I'm not a computer geek, but apparently to access this image, it wasn't just in your trash bin. It was in a very specific part that you could only access if you have these particular tools. But that's not, according to the defense attorney, that's not what the FBI told the U.S. Attorney's Office. The FBI said, in a routine search, we found this. They go to the U.S. Attorney's Office and says that. And then using that sort of, sleight of hand, that's how they were able to get a judge to be able to sign off on the warrant. Because there is legal precedent in the U.S. judicial system that you cannot just pull, you cannot just forensically dig into a hard drive and use that evidence without telling a judge or the authorities and be able to get a conviction off of that.
So I guess the bigger question here is, are Best Buy employees routinely using these tools to, root around in someone's computer looking for illegal materials?
Yeah, and that's the pretty explosive charge. And according to this attorney who's been in the game for, 47 years, they were not expecting this as well. They, in his just routine searches, getting information from the prosecutors and whatnot, that's what he discovered. And further digging, I found that this was happening more often than not. And here's the interesting story. Like, you could have these quack lawsuits all the time. And right now, this case is in front of U.S. District Judge Cormac Carney. Cormac Carney is not someone who takes quack attorneys lightly. And most famously and recently in Orange County, he threw out a case that the feds were preparing against two very prominent billionaires here, Henry Nicholas and Henry Samueli, threw out for lack of evidence and said that the prosecution was overreaching. Right now, he's not throwing out the case. Right now, he's asking the feds, saying, you guys have messed up right now, but I'm going to wait and see if you have more evidence proving that you were able to get this warrant all clean and there was no foul play in this.
So what does this mean in terms of nationwide? Do you think that the FBI, the feds have this policy with all sorts of retailers that we don't know about?
Of course. This is what I find most amusing about people shocked when stories like this come out. You really think big corporations aren't ratting you out all the time? You really think, and I'm not going to name any big corporations right now, but you really think that everything that you put out there into the ether sphere online that the feds aren't reading through everything, especially in the wake of 9/11, especially in the wake of NSA? Of course, it's just always surprising when someone is actually named and there's actual proof that this is offered. To me, the funniest thing was this: the guy who found this image goes to his superior, who was also an FBI informant, who then goes to another colleague, who was also an FBI informant. I thought more of Best Buy. Whatever.
Well, to argue the other side, what's wrong with someone saying, look, there's child pornography on this. It should be stopped if this guy's trafficking in child pornography.
Oh, no, absolutely. And again, if they were just doing, and Best Buy actually said that, like when we are going to do a full search, like a regular routine search, we let the customer know that if we find these images, hey, that we're going to report you to the feds. And they have every right to do so. And frankly, they have the obligation to do that. On the other hand, though, if you're accessing these images illegally without a warrant and without telling, without telling the person who's, or rather without telling a judge to sign off on a warrant to then go and raid someone's house, that's when you're breaking the law. So I guess, yes, and, you know, on one hand, they allegedly found this child porn there, and that's a problem in and of itself. But are you allowed to break all laws just to be able to nab someone on one particular breaking of the law? That, you know, that's for us civil libertarians. But in this day and age, no one likes civil liberties anymore.
So where does the case go now?
It's going to be heard later on this month. It's going to be heard again in Judge Carney's chambers. He's waiting for the FBI, for the feds, frankly, to show him that they did not break the law. And if they can't show him or they can't convince him that what they did was perfect and nice and clean, he'll probably throw out the case. And, you know, and especially here in Orange County, there's something in the water because you have so much prosecutorial overreach, especially with the OCDA. That's been the whole snitch scandal for the past couple of years. And in this case, though, it's involving the feds. And usually the feds here in Orange County are a little bit smarter than the OCDA.
Gustavo Arellano, editor of the OC Weekly and contributor to All Things Considered here on KCRW. Thanks, Gustavo.
Gracias.
Coming up, the story of a reporter who used her interviewing skills to create a new business, interviewing Alzheimer's patients about their lives so that nursing homes can provide better care. That story is next on Press Play. This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. People suffering from Alzheimer's disease slowly lose touch with their lives, who they are, what they've done, where they've been. And as they become increasingly incapacitated, many are moved into assisted living facilities where nurses and other caregivers don't really know much about them. The result can be impersonal care, care that can't look at a person's history or personality to understand or react to their behavior. Well, Jay Newton Small was concerned about that issue when she moved her dad into a care facility. But she came up with a solution. And so she quit her job as a Time magazine reporter and started a company. Jay Newton Small joins me now. Hi.
Hi, Madeline.
Well, first, tell us about your experience when you moved your dad into a care facility. What was the problem that you saw?
So I moved him into a home about 2.5 years ago, and they asked me to fill out this 20-page questionnaire about his life. And I was like, you're never going to remember 20 pages of handwritten data points for the 150 residents that you have here. Why don't you just let me write down a story for you? And they were sort of like, you're weird. And I was like, no, look, it's what I do. I'm a journalist. And so I wrote a story down for them, and they loved it. It actually completely transformed his care. People remembered the story. They remembered the anecdotes. He'd actually spent 20 years working in Africa with the United Nations, and two of his caregivers were from countries where he'd worked, and they loved that. They would sit for hours and show him photos of Ethiopia and Sudan. And so it really formed bonds and empathy with his caregivers in ways that the home had never seen before. And so they were like, wow, can you do this for everyone here? And that's basically how Memory Well started.
Memory Well is your company.
Yep.
And so what is it exactly? You write stories of people's lives, like bios, I guess?
Yeah, basically, we write the life stories of those living with Alzheimer's and dementia. And so we put them online. So if you go to our website, you'll see you can read people's stories, and then family members can upload their loved one's favorite music and art and videos and readings. So that way, when family members or caregivers sit with them, not only do they know their story and they can sit and show them photos from their lives, they also can engage with them with their favorite sort of music and video clips. And that way they really deliver much more personalized, much more sort of intimate care than the just sort of most of the activities, if you've ever been to any of these homes, are really impersonal. You sort of sit and throw the ball or read the newspaper or watch some movie. But this enables them to really tailor the interaction to that person and say, yeah, I know your favorite movie for my dad, for example, was MASH. He loved MASH. And so the minute you started showing him MASH, he would sit down and really pay attention. Or towards the end, when he didn't know me at all, and he was sort of, why is this strange woman and her dog following me around? I would bring the Beatles with me, and I would start playing the Beatles, and he just loves the Beatles, and he would always stop and then engage. And so it really helped me bring him back to who he was a little bit and bring him back to me, and that made it invaluable to me. And so I thought that not only is it important to tell his story so others understand him, but it was really important for me to give family members suffering from the same sort of struggles to connect, to relate, to really be able to find ways to connect and engage them.
And you say it was really good for you and good for family members. What about for him and for patients? How does it affect them?
Well, there's been studies in the UK. There's never been any studies in the US, but in the UK they've done, I think, 3 studies that show that telling life stories builds empathy between caregivers and the residents. It also builds empathy between family members and caregivers. And it also reduces depression amongst those residents. And it improves their quality of life, like tangibly. And so we believe that it's really important to tell these stories because if you've ever been to these homes, they're very isolating. They're very sort of depressing, and we want to be able to build community in these places so that not only when family members visit, but when other people visit, they know these people and they can engage with them.
How detailed do you get in terms of creating these stories? Because obviously most of these people are probably, you know, pretty elderly, or at least they've lived a long life. You could be writing for a long time.
So it depends. And up until this point, I should say, facilities have really been our main clients. And that's because they see the value in the stories, and they usually suffer from 55% turnover annually of these caregivers, because it's kind of a miserable job taking somebody to the bathroom 4 times a day who you don't know anything about. And it's worse when they start to bite and punch like my dad did towards the end of his life. And so really being able to find anything to help keep caregivers there, build empathy, is something that homes really find valuable. For the homes, we limit the stories to about 450 words so that you can print them out in a 1-page form. And a lot of homes either put them in their care plans, or they even will print them out and put them up on walls so that you can have like a whole memory wall, and anyone coming into that area can read about who the residents are and be able to engage with them. But family members have actually begun to approach us individually and say, hey, can you do a longer story about my dad? Like, because his life was so interesting and we want something a little bit more in depth. And so we've begun to tailor the stories more to individual families and sort of say, okay, well, if you want longer stories, we can also do that. And we've been approached by family members who don't have loved ones in a facility or in a home. They actually have their loved ones at home with them, or they are living in independent living, and they've asked us to start doing those stories. So the stories we found can be useful not only in the context of memory care, but even for other people suffering from, say, Parkinson's or any kind of degenerative diseases where they're having trouble explaining to people who they are, and it really gives voice to the voiceless.
So you were a political reporter for Time magazine.
Yeah.
And are you finding more meaning in this work than you were being a political reporter?
I do have to say, yeah, it is a lot more meaningful to me. And if you told me sort of 5 years ago that I would be writing the life stories of those living with Alzheimer's dementia, I would have told you that you're crazy. But, you know, after 14 years of covering the White House and Congress and the Middle East, the timing felt right on a bunch of levels to do this. I felt that I would always regret if I didn't give it a chance to bring stories and collect these stories that we're losing every day, because, you know, if you don't write them down, people forget them and they don't keep them. And so as a journalist, the idea of collecting these stories was really appealing to me, and becoming kind of a firsthand resource when we have thousands of them written on, like, let's say you're researching the Korean War or Woodstock, you know, being able to sort of say, yeah, here's all these firsthand testimonies and witnesses to these things. That really appealed to me. And then I think also after 14 years, the gridlock in Washington, the sort of whole political climate got to me too as well. And it was the timing, I think, was really perfect. And yeah. So it's much more fulfilling.
So your dad has died, and do you feel like this all this research you did, the biography you wrote, and just, you know, the process of living with his life, are you glad you did that? Now you have this memorial to him.
Yeah, it really became the first draft of his obituary, and it really made me feel like I have this thing now for when, if you know, hopefully if when I have kids, I can pass it down and say, here's dad, you know, here's who your grandfather was. And I'm building out his site that I can include interviews that I did with him and podcast versions, photos that he of him when he was younger. And that way it becomes like this living memorial. And I love that about that I can keep him with me and really kind of always have him, a part of him with me. And that's really special to me. And it's been really wonderful with my family as well, because sending them the story and sending them the site, it's provoked a lot of memories in their minds. And they've sort of, you know, I had like aunts and uncles in Australia and London who were like, oh, well, this reminds me of the time when Gray did this. And so it's actually enhanced my knowledge of my father, because they've come back to me with this wealth of information.
Well, Jay, thank you so much for sharing your story.
Thank you for having me on.
That's Jay Newton Small, former political reporter, and now she has a new company. It's called Memory Well. It's online at memory-well.com. Coming up on Press Play, are we in a restaurant bubble that's about to burst? The ingredients are there. Increasing rents, higher salaries, a glut in chef-driven restaurants.
It's just been heartbreaking to see these places all over the country close, because restaurants are personal. It's the chef and the owner, and they put their livelihood into it.
The future of farm-to-table dining, that's next on Press Play. This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. If you go out to dinner these days, you may end up in a certain kind of restaurant. In an old building, in a funky neighborhood, a hip young chef will be creating forward-thinking cuisine using ingredients sourced from local farmers, making homemade bread and charcuterie and craft cocktails, and serving it all on rough, reclaimed wood tables under Edison bulbs. In a three-part series, Kevin Alexander, national writer-at-large for the website Thrillist, has called this a good food revival movement. It's made for some great dining experiences, but now, he warns, it may all be coming to an end. Kevin Alexander joins me now. Welcome.
Thank you for having me.
Well, before we get to the end, let's get to the present and describe a little more about what you've called the good food revival movement. What is it?
Sure. So another way to put it, I think, is like the Portlandization of America. And it's essentially what has happened is a bunch of chefs trained nationally have taken their skills and kind of moved to secondary cities and created these almost like tent revival movements of good food. And so, you know, it's, as you described, it's the farm to table, and they're doing ambitious menus, and it's a lot of the same trappings everywhere. So you're getting the wood-fired pizza joint, and you're getting the ramen place, and you're getting the upscale barbecue place. Mm-hmm. And so you're seeing the same sort of thing, but it's happened all over the country.
And not just in secondary cities, right? In cities like New York and Los Angeles as well.
Oh, of course. But those have had a little more experience with it. Uh-huh. But so you're in those cities, what you're seeing is an increase in those types of restaurants. And what they'll do is find the neighborhoods that maybe aren't as crowded with culinary hotspots and create their own new sort of hip area.
So this has been generally regarded as a good thing because it's elevated dining. It has brought in more people to the experience, whether it be in the providing part or the eating part. It's made natural, good for you, good tasting food a priority. So this has been a good thing, right?
Yeah. I mean, from the perspective of having diners who are more informed, of eating food that's local, from all of those perspectives, it's a good thing. But where it turns bad is when that becomes unsustainable and it's getting to that point.
Okay, so let's talk about those ingredients for unsustainability. I guess one of the reasons would be that providing this farm-to-table cuisine is expensive.
Yeah, I mean, as I say, that it's sort of like this perfect storm. You've got rising labor costs, you've got huge rent increases, you've got a glut of similar restaurants, you've got customers not willing to pay higher prices. You have, because of that glut of restaurants, you have a shortage of cooks. And so what you're seeing is all of these things happening at once, and all of those restaurants that, you know, are ambitious and cool, they just can't sustain themselves, and so they end up failing.
But at the beginning, they could sustain themselves. So what happened? I mean, you profile one restaurant that did really, really well, and then in a matter of, what, 4 or 5 years, is now going out of business.
Yeah. So I talk about AQ in San Francisco, and a lot of what happened with them was the rising costs of labor, especially. So it was healthcare costs. You had to pay your cooks more to keep them because of the cook shortage. Everyone can just move around. There are rising food costs. And especially, I mean, San Francisco, the number is jarring. And when they opened, there were 3,600 restaurants in San Francisco. There are 7,600 now, and that's 5 years later.
Wow. Okay, so it seems like a simple law of supply and demand.
Definitely, some of that is, but it's also just the fact that that restaurant that you think about, you know, with the hip chef and the Edison bulbs and the reclaimed wood and the Mezcal cocktail program and all of that sort of stuff, those usually have scratch kitchens. So they have the same style kitchen as a fine dining restaurant, but with lower margins. And a lot of that stuff that we've now come to expect of our food is literally the cost of doing it. The margins are so small, and they were small already, that what started out as, you know, a little bit of success, a little bit of profit, is now no profit and thus no success.
So in a way, these chefs have created their own monsters by educating our palates, we diners.
No, I think that's right a little bit. But basically what it's done is it's created expectations in the diner that are unrealistic, because we're still not willing to pay the elevated prices that chefs need to keep these places in business. And that's sort of where there's this cognitive dissonance, because there's a lot of high-minded talk about, oh, an increase in minimum wage and all this stuff, and this is great. But if someone then sits down in a restaurant and sees that the burger costs $18 and they're like, I can't believe this burger costs $18. Well, you know, the money needs to come from somewhere. And so you need to be able to make all of the numbers make sense. And right now, customers have said, you know, they're not willing to pay these elevated prices, and they'll leave a restaurant if the prices go up. And that's sort of the tough place that restaurateurs have found themselves in.
So are you seeing a lot of restaurants now going out of business or threatening to go out of business?
Oh, yeah. I mean, all over the country. So I visited 19 cities, and it's really heartbreaking, because restaurants are personal. It's the chef and the owner, and they put their livelihood into it. And as I say in the piece, the bubble's not just going to burst like the financial market, where everything sort of, you know, wipes out at once. Because when something's personal, you'll still put money into losing it as long as possible. So different places will close at different times. But ultimately, right now, it's a bad bet. And it's just been heartbreaking to see these places all over the country close.
Now, you mentioned that labor costs are the primary reason for this problem. One of those reasons is rising minimum wages in cities across the country. How do chefs and restaurateurs feel about that?
A lot of them have mixed emotions, right? Because a lot of these people are, you know, open-minded and progressive, and they know that they want their chefs and cooks and people that work in the back of the house to have a livable wage. But the sort of flip side issue is, if the restaurant then goes bankrupt and they lose their jobs, you can't pay them a livable wage at all. So it's this sort of feeling that a lot of them have of sort of guilt, but also this is unsustainable as it stands.
It's always been a tough business, though. Is it just a lot tougher now? I mean, it's always that you hear these statistics like, you know, half of all restaurants will go out of business in the first 5 years. Is it worse now?
It is. It's I've talked to restaurateurs all over the country and chefs, and they say this is the hardest that they've ever seen it. I think the only comparable time was in 2008, when obviously the economy shattered. And I think the only good side, the good takeaway from that is that in 2008, you saw the food truck revolution. So people couldn't get loans to open brick and mortar places. So they started doing food trucks. You saw a lot of creative food come to that, especially in LA. And I don't know what will happen, but when chefs get put in a tight place, they tend to be creative and adaptable and create something new and interesting. And so if we can take sort of a silver lining away from all of these closures, it's that there will be new, interesting things created. We just don't know what those are. And in the meantime, you're going to see a lot of places closing.
But in the meantime, there are some chefs who make it and make it big. And I'm thinking here in LA of John Shook and Vinny DiTolo, and they own maybe half a dozen restaurants, Animal, Son of a Gun, part owners of Trois Mecs, Petit Trois, all these restaurants. How are they able to make this happen?
Well, I relate it to opening a restaurant, sort of like going into one of those money blowing machines in a roller skating rink. And you're trying to grab as much money as you can, but turns out all the money is fake except for one like dollar that has a lottery ticket on it. You know, these guys are that example in LA. In San Francisco, you have places like State Bird Provisions. You know, in Chicago, you have a place like Au Cheval. In Washington, D.C., you have a place like Rose's Luxury. There are restaurant unicorns that are national phenomenon, and it's due to a variety of things. Obviously, the skill of the chefs and all of that stuff. But they have to open a bunch of places in order to sustain themselves. And they're not necessarily, you know, millionaires coming out of this sort of thing. That's what I think the misconception is that you'll see these guys and you'll see them on TV and you'll see them being name dropped. And you think of someone like David Chang or whatever, and a lot of those guys aren't making crazy amounts of money from their restaurants. It might be from their fame. You know, they sign a deal with Audi, or they're then able to open a restaurant in Tokyo, and it's, but they're just not a lot of money to be made in restaurants alone.
So what does that mean for us, the people who go out to eat? Are we going to just stop going out to eat?
Yeah, I think you're done. No more going out to eat for you.
Okay.
I think you're going to see two things. I think you will see a lot of the sit-down restaurants, in order to survive, will have to raise prices. So what that means is casual fine dining will turn more into regular fine dining. So the places will become more like the places you go on your birthday or on your anniversary in that regard. I think the opposite way that things are going is there will be more and more of sort of like the hip, fast, casual places opening. And I'm seeing this all across the country. Probably the biggest example right now is Mark Ladner from Del Posto, which got a 4-star review in the New York Times, has a Michelin star. He's leaving to create his own fast casual pasta flyer joint. And so a lot of those cool places that we kind of named at the start will become counter service spots. So you'll still get the trappings of a cool sit down restaurant in terms of like the reclaimed wood, and it kind of feels hip, and it's got the mezcal cocktails or whatever, but you're going to have to bust your table.
Hmm. Okay. For the same price?
For a little bit of a cheaper price, because they don't have to pay the front of the house, but it's not going to be much cheaper than it is now.
So then what's going to happen to all those workers?
That's a good question. And I mean, that's really where the good news is the back of the house, because there is such a cook shortage, they're going to find jobs, because they're like a line cook is the most in demand in the profession. And so right now there's such a shortage of them that this glut of restaurants when they close, there'll still be jobs available on that end. And the front of the house is more interesting because the irony is the front of the house is sort of the servers and the bartenders tend to be people who are not necessarily professional, like professional servers, professional bartenders. They're kind of doing this until the other thing takes off, doing mm-hmm. this until the acting gig takes off, doing this until their writing gig takes off. But the back of the house are the people that are in for life. I think they'll be okay because there is such a shortage that the market will end up evening out. And I'm not, to be honest, I'm not really sure what will happen to the front of the house, except that the most talented ones will stay and maybe the others will just get more and more into their acting.
Or more Uber drivers.
Exactly. Exactly.
Well, thanks so much. That was really interesting.
Yeah, absolutely. Happy to do it.
That's Kevin Alexander. He's the national writer at large for the website Thrillist, where you can read his articles on the restaurant bubble. This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. Peanuts. For those with severe allergies to them, even eating a small amount could be lethal. That potential danger prompted doctors for years to advise parents to delay giving their kids foods containing peanuts. But there is new federal guidance out today that says the opposite. Parents should expose their children to peanuts, and when they're really young, as early as 4 months old, and they should do it often. Joining us to talk about this is Dr. David Fleischer. He's a pediatric allergist at Children's Hospital Colorado, and he helped write the new peanut guidelines. Welcome.
Thank you for having me.
Well, in your time practicing medicine, have you seen any changes in the number of kids coming in with allergies in general or peanuts specifically?
Absolutely. You know, over the last 15, 20 years, we've seen a rapid rise in the number of patients who've not just had food allergies, but also other allergic diseases, so allergic rhinitis, asthma, and eczema. So there's been a general increase in all allergic diseases over the last 15, 20 years.
And when it comes to a peanut allergy, had you recommended that parents avoid peanuts?
Well, the recommendations back in 2000 for the AAP, American Academy of Pediatrics, were to avoid peanut until you're about 3 years of age, along with other major allergens, so 2-3 years of age. Those recommendations changed about 8 years later, in 2008, when there really wasn't enough significant data to say that avoidance of these allergens made a difference in the rate of allergy, especially food allergy. And then over, I would say, the last 4 or 5 years, we started to see some what we call observational studies, where we noticed that if you introduce some of these foods earlier, like milk and egg and peanut, you may actually reduce the risk of you developing food allergy into these particular foods. And finally, in 2015, we had our first largest, what we call randomized controlled trial, which gives us the best evidence to show that if you actually gave peanut early versus avoiding it for 5 years, you can dramatically reduce the risk of the development of peanut allergy by almost 80%.
80%?
Yes, very significant. It was a fantastic study, with landmark study with respect to early introduction and how it can affect the timing of the development of peanut allergy.
And are these in children who are already prone to developing an allergy, or are these children who don't have any of those predispositions?
When you look at that study, the Learning Early About Peanut study, or LEAP study, these were what we called high-risk infants. So by the definition in that study, high risk was having severe eczema and or having egg allergy. High risk in previous studies and other studies may be differently looked at by having one parent or sibling having some allergic disease. So in this study, they wanted a higher kind of risk of the highest risk of patients having the risk of developing peanut allergy.
So now the new recommendations say that children who are at high risk, who have severe eczema or something else like that, should be given some peanut product as early as 4 months, when they're 4 months old?
Well, I think the best way to summarize the whole guidelines is probably it should be given around 6 months, but not before 4 months. When you look at the World Health Organization guidelines for breastfeeding, and breastfeeding may play a role in allergy prevention as well, they recommend strict breastfeeding until 6 months. I think there's a window of opportunity anywhere from 4 to 11 months or before age 1 year, when it's important probably to try to introduce all the major allergens, not just peanut. There's some data with egg as well and some other things, but I think our general feeling is, based on what we've seen with peanut and some of these other randomized trials, that there's really no reason to avoid any major allergen before age 1 year.
So that would be, as you say, milk, eggs. What about shellfish?
Peanuts, tree nuts, shellfish, fish. Again, it depends on the, you know, how you're going to introduce it and when you're going to introduce it. You need safe forms to introduce in these infants. They need to be able to eat foods, solid foods first. So you want to make sure that they've had more typical foods like a rice cereal or fruits or vegetables. You don't want to give them peanuts, directly shelled peanuts, because of the choking hazard. But in these guidelines, there's actually addendums that actually tell families and physicians how and what forms to use and safe forms to use, such as peanut flour, heating up peanut butter, making it into a soup and adding it to a fruit or vegetable, and how to give it in a safe form.
And often, right? Several times a week?
Yeah, I think the general thing is, probably the best way to say it is give it early and give it often. You know, the only thing that's been studied is about 2 grams of peanut protein 3 times a week for 5 years. Now, do you have to do it that often? Can you do it more or less? I mean, I think, again, getting in early and getting in often as the child will eat it is probably the most important thing than saying strictly you have to do it 3 times a week for X number of years.
So getting back to what you were talking about at the beginning of our conversation, that you've seen a rapid rise in children with allergies, Is that because parents have been avoiding giving them these foods?
I think it's played a role, but if you look at when the recommendations were to avoid these major allergens, the rise in food allergy, for example, is already occurring. So it may have played a role in contributing to it, but it's not the only reason there. You know, as with the development of asthma and other things, other diseases, there's multiple factors that play a role. Genetics obviously plays a big role, but even we see families now that don't have any family history, and some of their patients, their infants and children, have some of the worst eczema and food allergies. So there's a lot of different reasons this probably played some role, but may not have been the major role.
What are some of the other reasons?
They've looked at, again, genetics. If you have a family history of disease, looking at vitamin D, it has some protective effects. So there's multiple things, how you're exposed to the food. So if you're exposed early through the skin, that can sensitize you, actually. So patients that have severe eczema, you can measure protein and dust in your house with foods that you eat, and infants can be sensitized to the skin. So again, it's a kind of the timing of an exposure that may play a role, especially with food allergy.
And what about keeping an excessively clean house or that kind of thing?
It definitely, I mean, if you look at food allergy, that's the hygiene hypothesis, that the cleaner we become, our immune system has to not be as busy fighting off infections or the vaccines or antibiotics that we give. So it's just more possibly developing allergy. When you look specifically at food allergy, for example, infants that are born by C-section, so they're not exposed to bacteria, the normal vaginal bacteria, have a higher risk of having food allergies. So if you're exposed to the birth canal, you're colonized with healthy microbiome, a healthy bacteria. So that's where that kind of plays a role with food allergy.
Now, what about for adults? Is it too late for adults if they already have peanut allergies or any other kind of allergies? Is it too late to reverse?
It's too late to reverse, but we are working on treatments right now for patients. There are several forms. One is a epicutaneous or a patch that can be applied, and then proteins absorbed through the skin. You need to develop increased tolerance to that food over time. Other one is an oral immunotherapy where you eat larger doses mixed in with the food over time on a daily basis. And those two products are both in phase 3 trials, so hopefully close to getting FDA approval in the coming years, at least for peanut, and they will be examined also for milk and egg and other major allergens as well. So there's hope for treating. It may not cure every patient that has food allergy, but it may protect them from having an allergic reaction if they accidentally eat something that has that allergen in it, if they're on these therapies.
But again, the idea here is that there's a small window when you're a small child to prevent developing an allergy in later life, and we need to take advantage of that.
Right. That's what we think right now. I mean, is the window as narrow as 4 to 6 months, or can it be a little bit wider for certain foods? We're not going to know every single parameter of that. But I think with some foods like eggs, some of the early trials of the most severe patients with egg allergy were already allergic actually at 4 months. So some of these foods may somehow have to be given a little bit earlier, perhaps possibly mixed in with infant formula or breast milk to prevent those allergies in the most severe patients.
Well, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
That's Dr. David Fleischer, pediatric allergist at Children's Hospital Colorado. And Julie Myers is here now with the listener feedback.
That's right. And specific feedback from a server who heard our piece about the restaurant bubble. And Will Green on Facebook wrote us a message. He says that your guest talking about restaurants was wildly dismissive and disrespectful towards servers. Restaurants have been foisting their labor costs onto diners for decades with the tipping system. And if the guests don't like that food that the professional cooks have made for them, inevitably it gets taken out personally and financially on the part-time actor. So, wham for the restaurant owners. The servers are the ones that have it bad right now. So thank you, Will Green, for listening, and thank you for your service.
Okay, thank you for your service, Julie Myers.
Thank you for your service, Madeline Brand.
All right, and thank you for listening. I'm Madeline Brand. I'll see you tomorrow.